Thanks very much for that. When someone goes through your degrees and what you did, it reminds me of when I came for my interview here, John Dearlove, who can't be here tonight, his first words to me was, "My God, you've got a lot of degrees, haven't you?" I try and forget about that. But the topic in hand is European integration and representative politics. And what I want to do tonight is to, well, first of all, thank you for coming, because it's a gorgeous evening, so I particularly appreciate you sacrificing the sunlight. But what I want to do is to talk about the relationship between European integration as an issue and the nature of representative politics. The focus is not going to be particularly on the European Union, on the democratic deficit. I will certainly talk about that. But it's more to focus on the way in which the European issue plays out in domestic politics in Europe and a way of understanding what's going to go on. The two questions I'm going to try and ask, I've got two questions, about five paradoxes and about one answer. So you can judge me at the end of that whether I've covered those. Two questions I want to approach are: what role does European integration play in the domestic politics of European states? How do we understand the European issue? How does it work in domestic politics? And secondly, what role, if any, do representative politics play in the process of European integration? As I say, the emphasis will mainly be on the former rather than the latter. The topic comes very much as a summary of things I've done in the past, and I'm a comparative political scientist, which is sounds like a sort of confession one makes at Alcoholics Anonymous. But I mean it in a positive sense, to say that it means that I work very extensively with colleagues, and it's very nice to have most of those colleagues in the room tonight, and I will talk about some of their contributions to what I've been doing. So it's not an individual approach that you're getting. A lot of these things are actually due to other people, many of whom are here. The other two people I want to mention at the beginning, I guess this is sort of this Gwyneth Paltrow moment, which is that the two people that are very important to this lecture, and I only realised it as I was walking before the lecture, actually quite a way out of campus, heading north, wondering whether when to turn back. And it occurred to me that the title comes from two people who were very important to me when I arrived at Sussex in 1993, which were Helen Wallace and Bruce Graham. And Helen Wallace was and remains very important to me as somebody who gave me an academic home in the European institutes and welcomed me in, but also very much taught me about European integration, but taught me that we need to understand Europe comparatively, and we need to understand Europe not simply in terms of the European Union and the European community, but to look at it more broadly. And her mission was always to look at the wider Europe, to look at outside the borders of the European Union, and I think Sussex European Institute still has that imprint upon it with the work that we do in training people from outside, from candidate countries. The other person is Bruce Graham, who sadly died last year, but made a very strong mark on me. And the representative politics was his phrase, and it's, I mean, not, he doesn't own the phrase, but I'm using it very much in the way that Bruce would like to have it used, I think. Because Bruce was a comparative political scientist who looked at political parties. He looked at them truly comparatively. He looked at France, he looked at Australia, he looked at India, and he tried to understand the way in which parties work. And there are many people at Sussex who work on political parties. But what Bruce taught me was that parties are not interesting necessarily in their own right. They're interesting as a functioning of representative politics, of the way that the politics actually occurs and in the systems we have now. And that's what I'm trying to get at today, trying to think more broadly about that. The European integration project, to put these two questions together quickly, the last thing I want to say about this is the European integration project has very much been criticised for being democratically deficient. There is the democratic deficit is a frequent accusation levelled against it, for not having enough of a direct link to the constituencies that make it up of the 27 member states. At the same time, I think that representative politics in its broader sense is also suffering from a crisis, certainly a crisis of perception, that people perceived representative politics to not function that well, that politicians aren't functioning well, that parties aren't functioning well. So this lecture is trying to, it comes at you from the context of these two twin critiques, the critiques of the European Union for not being democratic and the critiques of representative politics. We have a technical word for that in political science. We call that a double whammy. And that's where we're starting from. It's not often one gets the opportunity to talk in the broadest terms, so forgive me for a few minutes. I think we don't really understand politics very well. And I hate to admit it, but I think the political scientists are partly responsible for that. Partly. I think in Britain we have a real problem about the way that politics is portrayed, a problem about an adversarial political culture, particularly an adversarial political media, that means we're looking for enemies and we're looking to attack the way that politics functions in a way that's sometimes very useful. I think it's very useful as an opposition in government, but I think that it does cramp our understanding of the way that politics actually occurs. And I want to make what I think, I hope, are kind of obvious points, but I think that these are points that are often ignored or contradicted by popular understandings of politics. By representative politics, I'm not making a normative claim. I'm not making a claim about the way politics should be. I'm saying this is the way I think that politics occurs. This is what I think happens in representative systems, in representative democratic systems. It's not a claim about the good, it's a claim about what is. Under representative politics, we have a citizenry, we have an electorate, but they're separate from the collective institutions of representation. We have a parliament, we have elites, we have assemblies at a higher level. They're distinct. Because we're distinct, we rely on intermediate institutions. We rely on political parties, we rely on interest groups to mediate between us and the political class. And political parties, therefore, are a crucial linkage mechanism. There are mechanisms, as I say, that are under attack, but they're also a very, very complex mechanism, and one that has a life of their own. And it's trying to understand that life of their own that I think I really am interested in politics, trying to understand the way that the political parties function. So we need these institutions, we have them, and although we berate them and we attack them and say they don't function very well, we rely on political parties, we rely on interest groups. My focus is mainly on parties here, so excuse me if I focus on that. We pick our leaders at national level, but also at European Union level, I'll pick mainly through political parties. Underlying this is an idea that politics is a complex and is a repeated game with, as I say, winners and losers here. Again, I think that sounds kind of obvious, but I also think that very often the way that politics is portrayed is that politics is not about winners or losers. Politics is about trying to create the common good or a unifying good for everybody. And I don't think that's possible. That's a very negative statement. But I think that underlying politics is conflict. Politics is not about making everybody a winner. It's actually about how to deal with losing. It's how to create coalitions and to minimise the losers, as it were. But very often the way that politics is portrayed is if anybody is losing, then politics is not functioning. Well, I think that essentially politics is about dealing with conflicts. If there weren't winners and losers, we wouldn't need politics, essentially. And representative politics is a way of dealing with that. It relies on certain institutions to help us try and function and to try and choose who wins and who loses. But it's also a repeated game. I'm influenced by the economists like Jim Rollo in SEI, but I'm not an economist. But I think the language of talking about politics as repeated games, as repeated conflicts and repeated solutions, sometimes settlements that last for a long period, is very, very important. That very often politics is portrayed as a one-time event, one decision that we have to make, and that's not the way it actually is in practice. The important parts of politics involve repeated conflicts. And lastly, those of you who know me will know that I've worked on populism, so I'm going to say something about populism, which is that I think that representative politics is given to moments, to movements, to episodes of populism, which essentially stem from a frustration with the functioning of representative politics. Essentially, populism is an anti-political movement that reacts against the functioning of politics. But there's an episodic, they happen occasionally, not as often as many people would say. But they're part of the life cycle, if you like, of representative politics. If we move back to the European Union and to the European integration project in its broadest sense, and what's representative politics got to do with that? Well, clearly, in the sense of the institutional architecture of the European integration project, not that much. We have one institution that's directly elected. Other institutions are indirectly elected, and some are not elected. But bear in mind that the very criteria for entry into the European Union, one of the key criteria is that it is essential that you have to be a representative democracy. We have the paradox here that the European Union requires systems to be representative in order to join a system that is not a representative political system. That's not a normative judgment on my part, it's simply to say that it doesn't function in the same way that representative political systems function. So what I want to do now is to look at four potential places in which representative politics, where the representative politics can meet the European Union issue and the issue of European integration. The first is the most obvious place to start, to look at the European Parliament, the only directly elected European Union level institution. What role does representative politics play? Well, clearly we have here a great opportunity for electoral politics. We have here an opportunity for parties to come and to compete over the issues of Europe, to compete about what sort of Europe there should be, whether there should be a European Union indeed, or to compete about what sort of functions the European Union should be carrying out. But in practice, European parliamentary elections don't function in that way. It's very rare in political science that we can say that everybody agrees, but we can in this case pretty much say that everyone agrees that European parliamentary elections are second-order elections. They're treated as second-order elections, which means that primarily domestic concerns prevail. European parliamentary elections are very rarely fought on European issues. Parties compete on a domestic context, in a domestic context, and on a domestic political agenda. Therefore, or perhaps as a consequence, very often the nature of the results in European parliamentary elections reflects not judgments on the European integration project or judgments on the effectiveness of the European Union, but very often reflect largely judgments on the nature of incumbent national governments. There are some caveats to that, but broadly we can say that European parliamentary elections are used to punish or to praise incumbent governments, more often to punish than to praise. We also know that if we look at European parliamentary elections, small parties tend to do well, the large parties of governments don't do so well because they're being punished for being associated with government very often. But these are a particular arena in which parties of protest can effectively deliver a very powerful message and get large levels of electoral support. But with the caveat that they do so in an electoral context that provides very, very low turnout. People are not voting in the same numbers at European levels that they vote for at national levels. That varies, of course, varies according to national context and varies quite dramatically. But broadly, turnout tends to be lower. So the European parliamentary elections are not a good place or don't seem to be an effective place for talking about Europe, for representing the issue of Europe. I also know, because I've been working with my colleague Tim Bale on the European Parliament, and we've had the pleasure of talking to 50 members of the European Parliament, talking in great depth to them about their roles. And what's interesting about this is that European parliaments can choose whether to be representative or not. One of them said to us, well, frankly, I could choose to lie here on my back on the floor smoking cigars and nobody would notice. very few actually do seem to choose to do that. Well, I guess they probably wouldn't have let us interview if they were doing that. But it's an interesting choice in a representative political institution that there's a clear distance. And that distance is for some a frustration for those parliamentarians. For some, it's an opportunity to pursue a particular policy agenda or sometimes to choose the constituencies that they represent. So it's not an attack on the MEPs, but it is to say that the members of the European Parliament reflect the background that they come from. They reflect the fact that they're elected to an institution that is not highly visible and not highly scrutinised by their electorate. So what about at the domestic level? What about the European issue in domestic party politics? I've been very lucky to be involved with my colleague Alex Sherbiak very closely with something that Joanne Wright, these two opposing Europe volumes that have come out this year. And there's a number of people in the audience who contributed to that. Giacomo Benedetto, Charlie Lees, Lucia Qualia. I'm sure I've missed somebody, but there were 34, so forgive me if I missed them. The project that we were looking at there was to look at how does Euroscepticism manifest itself across Europe? And again, this is a very large comparative project. And the point of looking at Euroscepticism is because it's very difficult to actually measure support for Europe because it's very much built into the consensus that support for Europe is not very apparent at party level. So the reason for looking at Euroscepticism was to see how is it that the European issue is contested, and we can only see it contested when parties start to oppose it. What can we observe from that? Well, we can observe some interesting comments. We can observe that Euroscepticism brings together some very strange bedfellows, that the Eurosceptic parties in different contexts come from very different ideological hues, that parties of the far left are parties of the far right, parties that are far out, like to oppose Europe, like to oppose it for very different sorts of reasons. So you get this strange amalgam of discontents, if you like, at the peripheries. But that Euroscepticism, in the end, the result of a lot of research, of many years, a lot of collaboration, has left Alex and I rather sceptical about whether there is such a unified concept as Euroscepticism. Sorry, I apologise for the too many scepticisms in there, but it is true. And there is a sense in which, you know, our overweening conclusion is we're not convinced that it's exactly the same thing that's always being contested. Even where parties do contest, say they're talking about the same thing, they're often talking about different motivations. And lastly, we are looking at the corners, the peripheries of the party systems in most cases. Most governmental parties, parties that stand a chance of being in office, are unlikely to express consistently a Eurosceptic agenda. It's not part of the consensus of the dominant parties to take such a position. The party systems in broadest terms don't like to contest Europe. They don't like to, it doesn't fit with the way that they contest politics in other respects. It doesn't fit well with left and right. It doesn't fit well with other issues. So the political parties have very little incentives to really contest it. So what about national elections? As a consequence, partly as a consequence of the work that Alex and I and others did on the Opposing Europe project, we widened this out to look at the nature of the European issue in domestic political conflicts. And Alex and I formed the European Parties, Elections and Referendums Network. The reason I say this is obviously self-publicity, but it's because what we did most effectively is we asked many academics to produce reports on elections and to write about not only the nature of those elections but whether those elections, what role that Europe played in it. And we've been very successful in asking academics. I'm always amazed that they agree to do this, but they do. God bless you if you're in the room. Some of you are. Over time, it's very, very clear that the European issue plays very little role in pretty much any domestic electoral contest. Even where there are protest parties, where there are some opposition, it's very rarely a major issue in the campaign. More significantly, the second point, though, even if it was to be important, we know from our studies of electoral behaviour and the way that voters think that voters are not moved to vote in terms of foreign policy, in terms of, in European policy. It's an issue of low importance to voters in terms of their voting behaviour. They might express a passionate concern about it, but when it comes to what's really going to make your decision as to who you're going to choose, it's going to be what we might consider the bread and butter issues of health and education and economy and those sorts of issues. Where it does matter, where parties do run on it, there are some single-issue protests about Europe, but where it combines with other political party agendas, I think it's actually tapping into broader concerns about politics. And it's actually an expression of a deeper sort of protest. All in all, national elections, we don't see Europe featuring very heavily. We have to remember here that we're in Britain, and Britain is unusual. We're unusually Eurosceptic. And for those of you that are British in the audience, we are unusual in that respect, and that we have to bear in mind that if we look across Europe, I'm talking in terms of generalities here, we're the only country where we can really talk about a Prime Minister, Thatcher, whose downfall was partly down to Europe. I'm interested if we can find examples of where the European issue has sealed the domestic fate of a political leader. The last place we might look for representative politics is in referendums. And it's quite clear that since 1992, perhaps a bit earlier, the Treaty on European Union, there's been the decline of what people have called the permissive consensus. The permissive consensus has been the idea that masses will go along with European integration, and as long as elites kind of don't talk about it to some extent, that they permit the elites to move forward with European integration. That's largely broken down in the sense that we can no longer assume that the populations will support European agendas. And referendums have both demonstrated that, and I think to some extent added to that tendency. We've seen since 1992 the proliferation of European referendums. And we've seen that referendums were used in two senses. They're clearly used in terms of membership. If a country is seeking to join, a candidate country wants to join, that decision is ratified or legitimated more properly through the use of referendums. And the same is true with institutions like the Euro and the European, like the Euro, with Sweden choosing not to join and so on. But also the referendums in the recent years have also been seen to be used by domestic political elites to try and ratify developments in European integration, the larger movements forward in terms of Nice, Amsterdam, and the constitutional treaty. As a political scientist, that gives me a lot of material, a lot of interesting material. And again, Alex Sherbiak and I worked together on looking at the referendums that occurred in 2003. And these were when there were 10 countries that were going to join the European Union in 2004, and 9 of them held referendums, 8 post-communist states and Malta. And for a political scientist, this was a very nice opportunity. We envy the hard scientists who have their laboratories and can control the environments and the conditions. I'm sure it's not true, but we like to think you do. And so when we've actually got the case of basically 9 countries holding a referendum on the same issue at the same time, broadly, we have a really nice opportunity to see what happens. And what did happen? Well, in that case, guess what? All 9 said yes. But all 9 said yes with different levels of support and different levels of turnout. But what seems to determine those levels of support, those levels of turnout, those levels of engagement in referendums is not the European issue or its relationship to those countries necessarily, but more the nature of domestic politics. High turnout associated with countries that generally turn out in high proportion for national elections. The awful truth for those of us interested in the European Union is that actually the domestic politics is what was driving the nature of those referendums largely. In 2005, I'm terrible with years, We had four more referendums on the constitutional treaty. We forget two of them because the Spanish and the Luxembourg said yes, but we remember the French and the Dutch rejections of the constitutional treaty. And this signaled to me a very, very important moment in the European project. First of all, it signaled the fact that it was a real crisis for this whole new process of constructing a European constitution or a constitutional treaty. It was a crisis for European elites. But it also, I think, changed the way that referendums were used. And I think in terms of the current Treaty of Lisbon, the fact that we only have one referendum projected for that is a consequence of these two rejections. The French and the Dutch voted no. But if you unpack the way that the voters were, the voters who voted yes actually voted very much for Europe. But the voters who voted no, the majority, were voting on issues that were not European. The French were voting on unemployment. The Dutch were concerned particularly about protecting their social model. And here you have one of those great paradoxes of the European Union. The French, insofar as they were opposing the European Union, were opposing it because it was too liberal, whereas the Dutch were concerned that it was not liberal enough, that it was attacking the crown jewels of Dutch politics. But domestic concerns were what essentially drove the negative votes in those cases. Now, the point about this, the crucial point, is here's a potential for representative politics, I've said, but actually the nature of referendums is not about representative politics. The nature of referendums is about direct politics, which is a wholly different type of politics. It's a politics of single votes, of single decisions about large issues, appropriate perhaps for membership, but very difficult, I would argue, to use as a way to legitimate developments in European integration. Very inappropriate. And also, these are moments that are very hard to reverse. Of course, the elites don't like that. They're prepared to go back to them. But the very politics of referendums is not the politics of iterated, of repeated games that we're used to in representative politics. And it prevents things from happening, which if you're a Eurosceptic is a good thing. But if you actually want to discuss the European issue, I think the dynamics of referendums tends to force you into a very polarized or binary case. And we see that very much in Britain today. The debate about Europe is very rarely about what sort of Europe. It's always been pushed in terms of whether it should be in or out. But European integration is a reality. The question is what sort of Europe we want to be involved in, whether it's less or more, rather than whether we're in or not. So the paradox is that referendums have allowed a direct link, but in terms of the European issue, they haven't actually fostered a great discussion about it, and I would argue are quite problematic for the future of the European integration project, in terms of not saying on a normative point of view whether I want to go forward or not, but whether they're not effective at getting people to talk about what it is that Europe should or shouldn't be doing. They don't focus on the details. Therefore, I'd like to make the case, if we're looking at across those four arenas, we have very little to get hold of. The European issue doesn't drop well into political party discourse. It doesn't function as a driver in domestic political elections. The European Parliament's elections are driven by domestic rather than European concerns, and referendums seem not to be the way forward. And I think that you see that, as I say, with the recognition that Lisbon is now only Ireland is going to use a referendum. And John Fitzgibbon, my research student, tells me that very much this is going to be a referendum about what? Well, about the nature of the current Prime Minister. The new Prime Minister, Brian Cowan, is that right? Who is seeing this as a way of legitimating his authority. So domestic politics, even in where we have a referendum, are still determining what's going to happen. So I think we need to normalise Europe. We face the problem that when we come to the European Union, it's anything but normal. I think I'm a comparativist, but I still understand that the European Union doesn't fit neatly into our existing kind of frameworks. We have a parliament that is not a legislature in the European case, because legislation goes through Council of Ministers, European Council as well, but the European Parliament. We have an executive that's the Commission, but not always the Commission. We have the traditional tools of political analysis are very hard to apply. Therefore, I think we need to treat the European issue in domestic politics as just another issue. And I think this is one of the real difficulties that politicians have. We tend to portray Europe as a yes or no decision. Should there be integration or should there not be integration? The fact that we go to referendums, we use referendums in that sort of decision is not appropriate. Just as the same way I think it would be strange to go to a population and say, should we have taxation or not taxation? Should we have a welfare state or not have a welfare state? Those are not the questions that one would ask. The questions that we need to ask are, what sort of taxation? What sort of welfare provision? What sort of education do we need? And that's the way that Europe needs to be normalised. The trouble is that politicians don't particularly seem to want to do that. I'm not actually blaming politicians in this sense. I think it's very difficult for them to drop the European issue into domestic political discourse. But I also think that as citizens, as Europeans, we need to also take some responsibility for that and to allow politicians to talk about Europe and to understand that this is about winners and losers, and sometimes we'll be losers. We need to treat it in the same way that we would treat an issue about health or education, and we don't at the moment. We treat it in a very different way as citizens. For political scientists and for students of European politics, the real challenge is actually to integrate the European Union with the study of domestic European politics. There is still very much a divide in the academic world between those that study the European Union and those that study European politics at domestic level. It represents perhaps a difference of psychological interest, if you like. Some people are interested in institutions of the European Union tend to be interested in policy. Those interested in domestic politics perhaps more interested in contestation. But in terms of dealing with issues, I think we need to learn that the study of the EU needs to understand domestic politics better, and domestic politics needs to understand European integration better and to integrate it. The two words you always long to hear, aren't they? In conclusion, I think Europe is important. I think it's important because I'm a European. I also do think that the European integration project is unprecedented, and as a political scientist, it's very interesting from that point of view. So I think that Europe is important. But I always tell my students that you should not assume that anybody has the same interests as you. Why should you want to know about these things? If you're not interested in Europe, why look at the European issue? Well, I've tried to make the case that it also helps us to understand the nature of representative politics. But I also think that the European Union issue and the difficulty of treating it as an external issue that is brought into politics is symptomatic of some of the new issues that are going to face us. Understanding the difficulties that the domestic politicians have in dealing with Europe, the difficulties that domestic electorates have in dealing with Europe, is symptomatic of the way some of the new challenges will be confronted or not confronted. And here I think about climate change. Here we have another issue that's clearly of global importance, that there is a great recognition, or at least a consensus on the large part of the populations, that we need to do something. But it doesn't fit with left and right. It doesn't fit with national boundaries, with the idea of sovereign states determining what's happening. It's very much like the European issue. So my point is that if we understand representative politics and why it works when it does and why it doesn't work sometimes, why we need to supplement it, we can also address some of the challenges of the future. Thank you very much.